Chapter 15 Life in the Clearings versus the Bush by Susanna Moody. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Lunatic Asylum.
Alas, poor maniac, for thee no hope can dawn. No tender tie, wake in thy blighted heart a thrill of joy. The immortal mind is levelled with the dust, ere the tenacious cords of life give way.
Our next visit was to the lunatic asylum. The building is of white brick, a material not very common in Canada, but used largely in Toronto, where stone has to be brought from a considerable distance, there being no quarries in the neighbourhood. Brick is not the substantial, august appearance that stone gives to a large building, and it is more liable to injury from the severe frosts of winter in this climate. The asylum is a spacious edifice, surrounded by extensive grounds for the cultivation of fruits and vegetables. These are principally worked by the male patients, who are in a state of convalescence, while it affords them ample room for air and exercise. A large gang of these unfortunates were taking their daily promenade when our cab stopped at the entrance gate. They gazed upon us with an eager air of childish curiosity as we alighted from our conveyance and entered the building. We were received very politely by one of the gentlemen belonging to the establishment, who proceeded to show us over the place. Ascending a broad flight of steps, as clean as it was possible for human hands to make them, we came to a long wide gallery, separated at either end by large folding doors, the upper part of which were of glass. Those to the right, opening into the ward set apart for male patients, who were so far harmless that they were allowed the free use of their limbs, and could be spoken to without any danger to the visitors. The female lunatics inhabited the ward to the left, and to these we first directed our attention. The long hall, into which their workrooms and sleeping apartments opened, was lofty, well lighted, well aired, and exquisitely clean. So were the persons of the women, who were walking to and fro, laughing and chatting very sociably together. Others were sewing and quilting in rooms set apart for that purpose. There was no appearance of wretchedness or misery in this ward, nothing that associated with it the terrible idea of madness I had been wont to entertain, for these poor creatures looked healthy and cheerful, nay, almost happy, as if they had given the world and all its cares the go-by. There was one thin, eccentric-looking woman in middle life who came forward to receive us with an air of great dignity. She gave us her hand in a most condescending manner, and smiled most graciously when the gentleman who was with us inquired after Her Majesty's health. She fancies herself Victoria, and in order to humour her conceit, she is allowed to wear a cap of many colours, with tinsel ornaments. This person, who is from the lowest class, certainly enjoys her imaginary dignity in a much greater degree than any crowned monarch, and is perhaps far prouder of her fool's cap than our gracious sovereign is of her imperial diadem. The mad women round her appear to consider her assumption of royalty as a very good joke, for the homage they rendered her was quizzical in the extreme. There are times when these people seem to have a vague consciousness of their situation, when gleams of sense break in upon them and whisper the awful truth to their minds. Such moments must form the drops of bitterness in the poisoned cup of life, which a mysterious providence has presented to their lips. While I was looking sadly from face to face, as these benighted creatures flitted around me, a tall, stout woman exclaimed in a loud voice, "That's Mrs. M. of Belleville! God bless her! Many a good quarter dollar I've got from her!" And running up to me, she flung her arms about my neck and kissed me most vehemently. I did not at first recognize her, and though I submitted with a good grace to the mad hug she gave me, I am afraid that I trembled not a little in her grasp. She was the wife of a cooper, who lived opposite to us during the first 2 years we resided in Belleville, and I used to buy from her all the milk I needed for the children. She was always a strange, eccentric creature when sane, if indeed she ever had enjoyed the right use of her senses, and in spite of the joy she manifested at the unexpected sight of me, I remember her once threatening to break my head with an old hoop, when I endeavored to save her little girl from a frightful flagellation from the same instrument. I had stepped across the street to her husband's workshop to order a new meat barrel. I found him putting a barrel together, assisted by a fine little girl of 10 years of age, who embraced the staves with her thin, supple arms, while the father slipped one of the hoops over them in order to secure them in their place. It was a pretty picture, the smiling, rosy face of the girl, looking down upon her father as he stood over the barrel, adjusting the hoop, his white, curling hair falling over her slender arms. Just then the door was flung open, and Mrs. Blank rushed in like a fury. "Katrin, where are you?"
"Here, mother," said the child very quietly.
"How dared you to leave the cradle without my lave?"
"Father called me,"
and the child turned pale and began to tremble.
"I came for a moment to help him."
"You little wretch!" cried the unjust woman, seizing the child by the arm. "I'll teach you to mind him! More nor you mind me. Take that and that." Here followed an awful oath, and such a blow upon the bare neck of the unhappy child, that she left her hold of the barrel, and fairly shrieked with pain.
"Let the girl alone, Mary. It was my fault," said the husband.
"Yes, it's always your fault, but she shall pay for it." And, taking up a broken hoop, she began to beat the child furiously. My woman's heart could stand it no longer. I ran forward and threw my arms around the child.
"Get out with you," she cried. "What business is it of yours? I'll break your head if you are not off out of this."
"I'm not afraid of you, Mrs. Blank, but I would not see you use a dog in that manner, much less a child who has done nothing to deserve such treatment."
"Curse you all," said the human fiend, flinging down her ugly weapon and scowling upon us with her gloomy eyes. "I wish you were all in blank."
A place far too warm for this hot season of the year, I thought, as I walked sorrowfully home. Bad as I then considered her, I have no doubt that it was the incipient working of her direful malady, which certainly comes nearest to any idea we can form of demoniacal possession. She is at present an incurable but harmless maniac, and, in spite of the instance of cruelty that I have just related towards her little girl, now, during the dark period of her mind's eclipse, gleams of maternal love struggled like glimpses of sunshine through a stormy cloud, and she inquired of me earnestly, pathetically, nay, even tenderly, for her children. Alas, poor maniac, how could I tell her that the girl she had chastised so undeservedly had died in early womanhood, and her son, a fine young man of 20, had committed suicide and flung himself off the bridge into the Moira River only a few months before. Her insanity saved her from the knowledge of events which might have distracted a firmer brain. She seemed hardly satisfied with my evasive answers, and looked doubtingly and cunningly at me, as if some demon had whispered to her the awful truth. It was singular that this woman should recognize me after so many years, altered as my appearance was by time and sickness. My dearest friends would hardly have known me, yet she knew me at a single glance. What was still more extraordinary, she remembered my daughter, now a wife and mother, whom she had not seen since she was a little girl. What a wonderful faculty is memory, the most mysterious and inexplicable in the great riddle of life, that plastic tablet on which the Almighty registers with unerring fidelity the records of being, making it the depository of all our words, thoughts, and deeds, this faithful witness against us for good or evil, at the great assize that hereafter must determine our eternal fate, when conscience, at his dread command, shall open up this book of life. Keep thy heart, my son, for out of it are the issues of life. Be sure that memory guards well that secret treasure,
all that the heart ever felt, the mind ever thought, the restless spirit ever willed, is there. Another woman, wild, dark, and fierce-looking, with her hands in mufflers, flitted after us from room to room, her black, flashing eyes fixed intently on my daughter. Yes, it is my own Mary, but she won't speak to me. The gentleman in attendance begged us to take no notice of this person, as she was apt to be very violent. Another stout, fair-haired matron, with good features and a very pleasant face, insisted on shaking hands with us all round. Judging from her round, sonsy, rosy face, you never could have imagined her to have been mad. When we spoke in admiration of the extreme neatness and cleanliness of the large sleeping apartment, she said very quietly, "Ah, you would not wonder at that, could you see all the water witches at night cleaning it?" Then she turned to me and whispered very confidentially in my ear, "Are you mad? You see these people, they are all mad as March hares. Don't come here if you can't help it. It's all very well at first, and it looks very clean and comfortable. But when the doors are once shut, you can't get out. No, not if you ask it upon your knees." She then retreated, nodding significantly. Leaving this ward, we visited the one which contained the male lunatics. They appeared far more gloomy and reserved than the women we had left. One young man, who used to travel the country with jewelry, and who had often been at our house, recognized us in a moment, but he did not come forward like Mrs. Blank to greet us, but ran into a corner, and turning to the wall, covered his face with his hands until we had passed on. Here was at least a consciousness of his unfortunate situation that was very painful to witness. A gentlemanly man in the prime of life, who had once practiced law in Toronto, and was a person of some consequence, still retained the dress and manners belonging to his class. He had gone to the same school with my son-in-law, and he greeted him in the most hearty and affectionate manner, throwing his arms about his shoulder, and talking of his affairs in the most confidential manner. His mental aberration was only displayed in a few harmless remarks, such as telling us that this large house was his, that it had been built with his money, and that it was very hard he was kept a prisoner in his own dwelling, that he was worth millions, and that people were trying to cheat him of all his money. But if that once he could get out, he would punish them all. He then directed my son-in-law to bring up some law books that he named on the morrow, and he would give him a dozen suits against the parties from whom he had received so many injuries. In the balcony, at the far end of the gallery, we found a group of men walking to and fro for the sake of air, or lounging listlessly on benches, gazing with vacant eyes upon the fine prospect of wood and water dressed in the gorgeous hues of an autumnal sunset. One very intelligent-looking man, with a magnificent head, was busy writing upon a dirty piece of paper with a pencil, his table furnished by his knee, and his desk the cover of his closed but well-worn Bible. He rose as we drew near him, and bowing politely, gave us a couple of poems which he drew from his waistcoat pocket. "These were written some time ago," he said. "One of them is much better than the other. There are some fine lines in that ode to Niagara. I composed them on the spot." On my observing the signature of Delta affixed to these productions, he smiled and said, with much complacency, "My name is David Moore." This, upon inquiry, we found was really the case, and the mad poet considered that the coincidence gave him a right to enjoy the worldwide fame of his celebrated namesake. The poems which he gave us, and which are still in my possession, contained some lines of great merit, but they are strangely unconnected, and very defective in rhyme and keeping. He watched our countenances intently while reading them, continually stepping in and pointing out to us his favorite passages. We were going to return them, but he bade us to keep them. He had hundreds of copies of them, he said, in his head. He then took us on one side, and entreated us, in the most pathetic manner, to use our influence to get him out of that place. He was, he said, a good classic scholar, and had been private tutor in several families of high respectability, and he could show us testimonials as to character and ability. It is hard to keep me here idling, he continued, when my poor little boys want me so badly at home. Poor fellows, they have no mother to supply my place. He sighed heavily, and drew his hand across his brow, and looked sadly and dreamily into the blue distance of Ontario. The madman's thoughts were far away with his young sons, or, perhaps, had ranged back to the rugged, heathery hills of his own glorious mountain land. There were two boys among these men who, in spite of their lunacy, had an eye to business, and begged pathetically for coppers, though of what use they could be to them in that place I cannot imagine. I saw no girls under 12 years of age. There were several boys, who appeared scarcely in their teens. Mounting another flight of snowy stairs, we came to the wards above those we had just inspected. These were occupied by patients that were not in a state to allow visitors a nearer inspection than observing them through the glass doors. By standing upon a short flight of broad steps that led down to their ward, we were able to do this with perfect security. The hands of all these women were secured in mufflers. Some were dancing, others running to and fro at full speed, clapping their hands and laughing and shouting with the most boisterous merriment. How dreadful is the laugh of madness! How sorrowful the expressions of their diabolical mirth! Tears and lamentations would have been less shocking, for it would have seemed more natural. Among these raving maniacs I recognized the singular face of Grace Marks, no longer sad and despairing, but lighted up with the fire of insanity, and glowing with a hideous and fiend-like merriment. On perceiving that strangers were observing her, she fled, shrieking away like a phantom, into one of the side rooms. It appears that even in the wildest bursts of her terrible malady, she is continually haunted by a memory of the past. Unhappy girl, when will the long horror of her punishment and remorse be over? When will she sit at the feet of Jesus, clothed with the unsullied garments of his righteousness, the stain of blood washed from her hand, and her soul redeemed and pardoned in her right mind? It is fearful to look at her and contemplate her fate in connection with her crime. What a striking illustration does it afford of that awful text, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." There was one woman in this ward, with raven hair and eyes, and a sallow, unhealthy complexion, whom the sight of us transported into a paroxysm of ungovernable rage. She rushed to the door, and doubled her fists at us, and began cursing and swearing at a furious rate, and then she laughed, such a laugh as one might fancy Satan uttered when he recounted in full conclave his triumph over the credulity of our first mother. Presently she grew outrageous, and had to be thrown to the ground and secured by two keepers. But to silence her was beyond their art. She lay kicking and foaming, and uttering words too dreadful for human ears to listen to. And Grace Marks came out from her hiding-place, and performed a thousand mad gambols round her, and we turned from the piteous scene, and I, for one, fervently thanked God for my sanity, and inwardly repeated those exquisite lines of the peasant bard of my native country. O thou who bidst the vernal juices rise, thou on whose blast autumnal foliage flies, let peace ne'er leave me, nor my heart grow cold, whilst life and sanity are mine to hold. We cast but a cursory glance on the men who occupied the opposite ward. We had seen enough of madness and the shrieks from the outrageous patients above, whom strangers have seldom nerve enough to visit, quickened our steps as we hurried from the place. We looked into the large ballroom before we descended the stairs, where these poor creatures are allowed at stated times to meet for pleasure and amusement. But such a spectacle would be to me more revolting than the scene I had just witnessed. The delirium of their frightful disease would be less shocking in my eyes than the madness of their mirth. The struggling gleams of sense and memory in these unhappy people reminded me of a beautiful passage in Tupper's Proverbial Philosophy. On all things created remaineth the half-effaced signature of God, somewhat of fair and good, though blotted by the finger of corruption. What a sublime truth! How beautifully and forcibly expressed! With what a mournful dignity it invests our fallen nature! Sin has marred the divine image in which we were made, but the soul, in its intense longing after God and good, bears in its sorrowful servitude to evil the impress of the hand that formed it happy and free. Yes, even in the most abject and fallen, some slight trace of good remains, some spark of the divine essence that still lingers amid the darkness and corruption of guilt, to rekindle the dying embers and restore them once more to life and liberty. The madman, raving in his chains, still remembers God, to bless or blaspheme his name. We are astonished at his ecstatic dreams of happiness, or shocked beyond measure at the blackness of his despair. His superhuman strength fills us with wonder, and, even in the extinction of reason, we acknowledge the eternal presence of God, and perceive flashes of his spirit breaking through the dark material cloud that shades, but cannot wholly annihilate the light of the soul, the immortality within. The poor, senseless idiot, who appears to moral eyes a mere living machine, a body without a soul, sitting among the grass and playing with the flowers and pebbles in the vacancy of his mind, is still a wonderful illustration of the wisdom and power of God. We behold a human being inferior in instinct and intelligence, of the meanest orders of animal life, dependent upon the common charities of his kind for subsistence, yet conscious of the friend who pities his helplessness, and of the hand that administers to his wants. The spirit of his Maker shall yet breathe upon the dull chaos of his stagnant brain, and open the eyes of this blind of soul into the light of his own eternal day. What a lesson to the pride of man, to the vain dwellers in houses of clay! Returning from the asylum, we stop to examine Trinity College, which is on the opposite side of the road. The architect, K. Tully, Esquire, has shown considerable taste and genius in the design of this edifice, which, like the asylum, is built of white brick, the corners, doors, and windows faced with cut stone. It stands back from the road in a fine park-like lawn, surrounded by stately trees of nature's own planting. When the college is completed, it will be one of the finest buildings in the province, and form one of the noblest ornaments to this part of the city.
The Maniac. The wind at my casement screamed shrilly and loud, and the pale moon looked in from her mantle of cloud. Old ocean was tossing in terrible might, and the black rolling billows were crested with light. Like a shadowy dream on my senses that hour stole the beautiful vision of grandeur and power, and the sorrows of life that brought tears to mine eye were forgot in the glories of ocean and sky. O Nature, I cried, in thy beautiful face all the wisdom and love of thy Maker I trace. Thy aspect divine checks my tears as they start, and fond hopes long banished flow back to my heart. Thus musing, I wandered alone to the shore, to gaze on the waters and list to their roar, when I saw a poor lost one bend over the steep of the beetling cliff that juts out o'er the deep. The wind waved her garments, and April's rash showers hung like gems in her dark locks, enwreathed with wild flowers. Her bosom was bared to the cold midnight storm that unsparingly beat on her thin, fragile form. Her black eyes flashed sternly, whence reason had fled, and she glanced on my sight like some ghost of the dead. As she sang a loud strain to the hoarse, dashing surge, that rang on my ears like the plaint of a dirge. And he, who had left her to madness and shame, who had robbed her of honour and blasted her fame? Did he think in that hour of the heart he had riven, the vows he had broken, the anguish he'd given? And where was the infant whose birth gave the blow to the peace of his mother and maddened her woe? A thought rushed across me. I asked for her child. With a wild laugh of triumph the maniac replied, "Where the dark tide runs strongest, the cliff rises steep. Where the wild waters eddy, I've rocked him to sleep. His sleep is so sound that the rush of the stream, when the winds are abroad, cannot waken his dream. And see you that rock, with its surf-beaten side? There the blood of my false love runs red with the tide. The sea-mew screams shrilly, the white breakers rave. In the foam of the billow I'll dance o'er his grave." Mid the roar of the tempest, the wind's hollow moan, there rose on my chilled ear a faint dying groan. The billows raged on, the moon smiled on the flood, but vacant the spot where the maniac had stood. I turned from the scene, on my spirit there fell a question that saddened my heart like a knell. I looked up to heaven, but I breathed not a word, for the answer was given, "Trust thou in the Lord."
End of chapter 15.